Early in the war, there had been two separate incidents, barely noticed by most Americans. On November 2, 1965, in front of the Pentagon in Washington, as thousands of employees were streaming out of the building in the late afternoon, Norman Morrison, a 32-year-old pacifist, father of three, stood below the third-floor windows of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, doused himself with kerosene, and set himself afire, giving up his life in protest against the war. Also that year, in Detroit, an 82-year-old woman named Alice Hertz burned herself to death to make a statement against the horror of Indochina. A remarkable change in sentiment took place. In early 1965, when the bombing of North Vietnam began, 100 people gathered on the Boston Common to voice their indignation. On October 15, 1969, the number of people assembled on the Boston Common to protest the war was 100,000. Perhaps 2 million across the nation gathered that day in towns and villages that had never seen an anti-war meeting. In the summer of 1965, a few hundred people had gathered in Washington to march in protest against the war. The first in line, historian Stoughton Lind, SNCC organizer Bob Moses, and longtime pacifist David Dellinger were splattered with red paint by hecklers. But by 1970, the Washington peace rallies were drawing hundreds of thousands of people. In 1971, 20,000 came to Washington to commit civil disobedience, vying to tie up Washington traffic to express their revulsion against the killing still going on in Vietnam. 14,000 of them were arrested, the largest mass arrest in American history. Hundreds of volunteers in the Peace Corps spoke out against the war. In Chile, 92 volunteers defied the Peace Corps director and issued a circular denouncing the war. 800 former members of the Corps issued a statement of protest against what was happening in Vietnam. The poet Robert Lowell, invited to a White House function, refused to come. Arthur Miller, also invited, sent a telegram to the White House: "When the guns boom, the arts die." Singer Eartha Kitt was invited to a luncheon on the White House lawn and shocked all those present by speaking out in the presence of the president's wife against the war. A teenager, called to the White House to accept a prize, came and criticized the war. In Hollywood, local artists erected a 60-foot tower of protest on Sunset Boulevard. At the National Book Award ceremonies in New York, 50 authors and publishers walked out on a speech by Vice President Humphrey in a display of anger at his role in the war. In London, two young Americans gate-crashed the American ambassador's elegant 4th of July reception and called out a toast to all the dead and dying in Vietnam. They were carried out by guards. In the Pacific Ocean, two young American seamen hijacked an American munitions ship to divert its load of bombs from air bases in Thailand. For 4 days, they took command of the ship and its crew, taking amphetamine pills to stay awake until the ship reached Cambodian waters. The Associated Press reported in late 1972 from York, Pennsylvania, 5 anti-war activists were arrested by the state police today for allegedly sabotaging railroad equipment near a factory that makes bomb casings used in the Vietnam War. Middle-class and professional people, unaccustomed to activism, began to speak up. In May 1970, the New York Times reported from Washington, 1,000 establishment lawyers joined war protest. Corporations began to wonder whether the war was going to hurt their long-range business interests. The Wall Street Journal began criticizing the continuation of the war. As the war became more and more unpopular, people in or close to the government began to break out of the circle of assent. The most dramatic instance was the case of Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg was a Harvard-trained economist, a former Marine officer, employed by the Rand Corporation, which did special, often secret research for the U.S. government. Ellsberg helped write the Department of Defense history of the war in Vietnam, and then decided to make the top-secret document public with the aid of his friend, Anthony Russo, a former Rand Corporation man. The two had met in Saigon, where both had been affected in different experiences by direct sight of the war and had become powerfully indignant at what the United States was doing to the people of Vietnam. Ellsberg and Russo spent night after night after hours, at a friend's advertising agency, duplicating the 7,000-page document. Then Ellsberg gave copies to various congressmen and to the New York Times. In June 1971, the Times began printing selections from what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. It created a national sensation. The Nixon administration tried to get the Supreme Court to stop further publication, but the court said this was prior restraint of the freedom of the press and thus unconstitutional. The government then indicted Ellsberg and Russo for violating the Espionage Act by releasing classified documents to unauthorized people. They faced long terms in prison if convicted. The judge, however, called off the trial during the jury deliberations because the Watergate events unfolding at the time revealed unfair practices by the prosecution. Ellsberg, by his bold act, had broken with the usual tactic of dissidents inside the government, who bided their time and kept their opinions to themselves, hoping for small changes in policy. A colleague urged him not to leave the government because there he had access, saying, "Don't cut yourself off, don't cut your throat." Ellsberg replied, "Life exists outside the executive branch." The anti-war movement, early in its growth, found a strange new constituency: priests and nuns of the Catholic Church. Some of them had been aroused by the civil rights movement, others by their experiences in Latin America, where they saw poverty and injustice under governments supported by the United States. In the fall of 1967, Father Philip Berrigan, a Josephite priest who was a veteran of World War II, joined by artist Tom Lewis and friends David Eberhardt and James Mengel, went to the office of a draft board in Baltimore, Maryland, drenched the draft records with blood, and waited to be arrested. They were put on trial and sentenced to prison terms of 2 to 6 years. The following May, Philip Berrigan, out on bail in the Baltimore case, was joined in a second action by his brother Daniel, a Jesuit priest who had visited North Vietnam and seen the effects of U.S. bombing. They and seven other people went into a draft board office in Catonsville, Maryland, removed records, and set them afire outside in the presence of reporters and onlookers. They were convicted and sentenced to prison and became famous as the Catonsville Nine. Dan Berrigan wrote a meditation at the time of the Catonsville incident. "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise. We say, killing is disorder. Life and gentleness and community and unselfishness is the only order we recognize. For the sake of that order, we risk our liberty, our good name. The time is past when good men can remain silent, when obedience can segregate men from public risk, when the poor can die without defense." When his appeals had been exhausted and he was supposed to go to prison, Daniel Berrigan disappeared. While the FBI searched for him, he showed up at an Easter festival at Cornell University, where he had been teaching. With dozens of FBI men looking for him in the crowd, he suddenly appeared on stage. Then the lights went out. He hid inside a giant figure of the Bread and Puppet Theater, which was on stage, was carried out to a truck, and escaped to a nearby farmhouse. He stayed underground for 4 months, writing poems, issuing statements, giving secret interviews, appearing suddenly in a Philadelphia church to give a sermon and then disappearing again, baffling the FBI, until an informer's interception of a letter disclosed his whereabouts and he was captured and imprisoned. The one woman among the Catonsville Nine, Mary Moylan, a former nun, also refused to surrender to the FBI. She was never found. Writing from underground, she reflected on her experience and how she came to it. "We had all known we were going to jail, so we all had our toothbrushes. I was just exhausted. I took my little box of clothes and stuck it under the cot and climbed into bed. Now, all the women in the Baltimore County Jail were black. I think there was only one white. The women were waking me up and saying, 'Aren't you going to cry?' I said, 'What about?' They said, 'You're in jail.' And I said, 'Yeah, I knew I'd be here.' I was sleeping between two of these women, and every morning I'd wake up and they'd be leaning on their elbows watching me. They'd say, 'You slept all night,' and they couldn't believe it. They were good, We had good times. I suppose the political turning point in my life came while I was in Uganda. I was there when American planes were bombing the Congo, and we were very close to the Congo border. The planes came over and bombed two villages in Uganda. Where the hell did the American planes come in? Later, I was in Dar es Salaam, and Chou En-lai came to town. The American embassy sent out letters saying that no Americans were to be on the street, because this was a dirty communist leader. But I decided this was a man who was making history, and I wanted to see him. When I came home from Africa, I moved to Washington, and had to deal with the scene there and the insanity and brutality of the cops, and the type of life that was led by most of the citizens of that city, 70% black. And then Vietnam, and the napalm, and the defoliants, and the bombings. I got involved with the women's movement about a year ago. At the time of Catonsville, going to jail made sense to me, partially because of the black scene, so many blacks forever filling the jails. I don't think it a valid tactic anymore. I don't want to see people marching off to jail with smiles on their faces. I just don't want them going. The 70s are going to be very difficult, and I don't want to waste the sisters and brothers we have by marching them off to jail and having mystical experiences or whatever they're going to have. The effect of the war and of the bold action of some priests and nuns was to crack the traditional conservatism of the Catholic community. On Moratorium Day, 1969, at the Newton College of the Sacred Heart near Boston, a sanctuary of bucolic quiet and political silence, the great front door of the college displayed a huge painted red fist. At Boston College, a Catholic institution, 6,000 people gathered that evening in the gymnasium to denounce the war. Students were heavily involved in the early protests against the war. A survey by the Urban Research Corporation for the first 6 months of 1969 only, and for only 232 of the nation's 2,000 institutions of higher education, showed that at least 215,000 students had participated in campus protests, that 3,652 had been arrested, that 956 had been suspended or expelled. Even in the high schools in the late 60s, there were 500 underground newspapers. At the Brown University commencement in 1969, two-thirds of the graduating class turned their backs when Henry Kissinger stood up to address them. The climax of protest came in the spring of 1970, when President Nixon ordered the invasion of Cambodia. At Kent State University in Ohio on May 4th, when students gathered to demonstrate against the war, National Guardsmen fired into the crowd. Four students were killed. One was paralyzed for life. Students at 400 colleges and universities went on strike in protest. It was the first general student strike in the history of the United States. During that school year of 1969-1970, the FBI listed 1,785 student demonstrations, including the occupation of 313 buildings. The commencement day ceremonies after the Kent State killings were unlike any the nation had ever seen. From Amherst, Massachusetts, came this newspaper report. The 100th commencement of the University of Massachusetts yesterday was a protest, a call for peace. The roll of the funeral drum set the beat for 2,600 young men and women marching in fear, in despair, and in frustration. Red fists of protest, white peace symbols, and blue doves were stenciled on black academic gowns, and nearly every other senior wore an armband representing a plea for peace.